When our best fur friends leave our world, many of us are left wanting one last scritch, one last hug, one last walk together. One Last Network is a space for pet guardians to honor their pets in their senior years and to cope with the days leading up to and after their passing. Here's your host, Angela Schneider, founder of One Last Network and Big White Dog Photography in Spokane, Washington.
Sainert of Lance and Lily Photography, covering the Washington, D.C. area, takes the mic today and interviews Jesse Scheip, a licensed veterinary technician with a specialty in behavior. Jesse also has training certification from the Karen Pryor Academy and has worked with Dr. Amy Pike of the Animal Behavior Wellness Center in Fairfax, Virginia. That's where Lynn met Jesse, looking for help with her sweet boy, Lance. Jesse enjoys teaching pet guardians how to understand their pets and how to use behavior principles to ensure they grow together and live their best lives together. Today, Lynn and Jesse have an in-depth discussion about canine cognitive disorder.
We all know my Lance has a few behavior issues, and Jesse worked with his vet issues for many years, and Lance loves Jesse. You know, we call her, you know, his girlfriend, and she is one of the few people that Lance likes when he goes into a vet setting, and he will, you know, go in Jesse's lap and be like, okay, lady, I love you. You're awesome. So that's how we became acquainted with Jesse, and she is, you know, part of our family and part of Lancey's team. So Jesse recently opened Mindful Mentor Behavior Counseling. And so Jesse, could you tell me about your business and the services you offer to your patients?
Definitely. So, you know, as you mentioned, I spent several years working in behavior specialty as sort of the number two for a boarded veterinary behaviorist. So in specialty, you tend to see like the most intense cases that, you know, have not responded appropriately to treatment, or their general practitioners don't feel equipped to help them with that. So it's sort of like the top tier. If someone who's a veterinary behaviorist can't help you, you're kind of stuck. And so for a long time, I absolutely loved working with those critters. But the more I sort of got involved in the behavior community, the more I realized there was sort of a void in the middle ground when it comes to behavior cases. So in the Northern Virginia area, we're really lucky to have, two boarded veterinary behaviorists and at least two or three residents, some who have moved on to open their own practices. So we do have a lot of resources for those upper tiers, but then also we have a lot of great trainers and, you know, group classes and stuff that are available for some of the more, you know, introductory preventative, like I just want to teach my dog how to do fun training stuff. But that area in the middle where they're not really intense enough that they maybe need to go to the veterinary behaviorist, but they're more advanced for sort of your standard preventative trainer to help. You know, so my role with the company is to coordinate with veterinary practices around the area. So their veterinarian is still in charge of diagnosing and testing and prescribing for the behavior problem. But then I take over a lot of the educational, counseling, and emotional support side of things, because that's where it's really time consuming and you need a lot of practice and education to be successful with that. You know, and so a lot of general practitioners, they sort of shy away from behavior cases because that's 90% of it, as I'm sure you can attest to over the years. It's, yeah, we can throw medication and we can do tests, but I need somebody who can talk to me about these problems and help point me in the right direction. And what are some things that I can do on a day-to-day basis to make living easier for both of us? And that's the part of behavior that I really, really enjoy, is the counseling and the education. So I try to build a company around being able to serve that to the local community.
That's great. Yeah, no, I know we were total naive pet parents. And then, you know, having a dog like Lancey come into your life, really needed a lot of education and probably still do, but you know, it's been great, and we've had, you know, wonderful resources, and you've been a great resource for us throughout the year, so we thank you for that.
Thank you.
So the reason for our discussion today is we're going to talk about canine cognitive disorder, otherwise known as doggy dementia or CCD. So can you explain to everybody what canine cognitive disorder is and what are some of the symptoms of canine cognitive disorder or doggy dementia?
Definitely. So the easiest way to explain CCD is basically calling it doggy Alzheimer's. So it's a degenerative disorder where your brain function just sort of starts declining. And there's a lot of different symptoms depending on your severity and, you know, the age of the animal. Some of the earliest signs that we'll see are going to be what we call sundowner syndrome, where the dog sleeps all day, but then they become more agitated or animated in the evening or throughout the night. They might have episodes of house soiling, whereas for the longest time they had impeccable, you know, soiling habits where they always go outside, but now they, you know, occasionally have an accident in the house. Some other symptoms might be just increased agitation and just can't seem to settle, get comfortable, changes in social interactions, where maybe before they were very pro-social and now they're kind of isolating themselves or vice versa. Purina has a really awesome sort of like grading checklist for a lot of those major symptoms, because we use the abbreviation DSHA when we're trying to diagnose cognitive dysfunction. DSHA is an acronym that we use as part of the diagnostic criterion for cognitive dysfunction. So the D stands for disorientation, because they might get kind of lost. Some people will describe finding their dog in a random room of the house, sort of staring at a wall. They might go outside and kind of forget where they are and then come back to the owner a little confused. So disorientation, then we've got interaction, so changes in social interactions, where, you know, historically I might have an animal who's very pro-social, but then they start isolating themselves or vice versa. We'll have sleep-wake cycle changes. So that's your S. And we talked a little bit about the sundowners already, where they're restless at night, but sleeping heavily during the daytime. The H then is house soiling, where, you know, they'll start having accidents in the house. And I think sometimes part of this is they either forget that they had to go to the bathroom when they were outside, and then they come back in and go, oh boy, I have to go to the bathroom, and they go to the bathroom. Or they just aren't as in tune with their body's needs. And so they wait till the very last minute before asking, and then it's like, whoops, too late. And then there's two A's at the end of DSHA. So the first one is activity level changes, where I might have increased agitation or lethargy. You can have either or. And then the last one is anxiety, where we might develop some new fears and phobias. For example, I might have an older dog who develops distress with thunderstorms, whereas before they'd actually been okay with those. So again, DSHA is just an acronym that we use to help kind of identify some of the symptoms that we're seeing with these pets.
Okay. Yeah. I know Lancy already has the, you know, sensitivity to noises down, but, you know, hopefully it doesn't progress beyond that. Now, are there other related cognitive disorders along the same lines, or could these signs also be signs of other diseases in dogs, or any, are they related to any neurological diseases in dogs?
Yeah, definitely. So their cognitive dysfunction is sort of a broad term for probably a lot of smaller disorders that we maybe haven't had the opportunity or the funding to like really pinpoint what these different ones are. From the symptomatic standpoint, I find cognitive dysfunction has a lot of similarities with chronic pain, which is also very common in older dogs. So one of the things that we'll always want to check for is, do we have a pain component here? And is that what is really driving a lot of these things versus I just have a senility problem?
So how do you determine whether it's a pain issue or a senility issue?
Very carefully. So Unfortunately, sometimes for both of these problems, they're kind of rule out diagnoses. And so a rule out diagnosis basically means I have to kind of run the gamut of the tests and say, well, it's not this, that, or the other thing. So it's probably cognitive dysfunction or probably a pain problem. So in my mind, I feel like senility is more of a rule out, because technically to diagnose that definitively, you have to do an MRI. Whereas with pain issues, it's, you know, we can do things like a gait analysis, which is basically where the owner takes video of the animal moving at home and then bringing it to the clinic with them. Because as a lot of pet owners can attest to, they might be three-legged lame at home, but they walk into the vet clinic and they're like, no, everything's fine. This doesn't hurt, la, la, la. So honestly, I feel like trying to assess pain in the veterinary clinic is very, very difficult, especially when you have a chronic pain versus an acute pain problem. So the big difference between those two types of pain issues is when you've got acute pain, the difference in sensation between how I was 5 seconds ago and how I'm feeling right now is very vast. So it's much more obvious. It's kind of like if you're thinking about the brightness of a light bulb, if I was already getting, I don't know, 50% light from my light source, and then I tweaked it to 50, I'm probably not going to notice that very much. Whereas if it's 10 to 90, that's a huge difference. And I can tell that it's much brighter than it was before. And the same is true when we've got pain sensation. So if I was totally fine and then I broke my leg, obviously that's going to hurt a lot. And so my behavior is going to reflect that level of pain, and I'm going to be very agitated and uncomfortable and not going to use that leg regardless of where I am and who I'm interacting with. Whereas chronic pain, on the other hand, it has more of an insidious onset. So for 1 month, you're at 10%. And then a couple months later, you're at 20%. And then 30, and then finally, maybe at 40%, you're like, okay, now I'm going to start slowing down. I don't want to play as much as I used to. I'm not going to use the stairs like I did. And so with chronic pain, the animal has time to adjust its behavior to their pain in order to manage it better, which also means the pet owner has time to acclimate to those slow changes in behavior as well. So if I bring a 12-year-old dog who's been experiencing chronic pain for 2 years to the vet and I say, how's he doing? You're going to say, no, he's totally fine. You know, he's still running around and playing. But if I'm like, well, here's your dog now, here's your dog from 2 years ago, there's a huge difference there. But because we have so much time between those two points, it's much less obvious for the pet, the owner, and then the clinician who's trying to do the diagnosing here. So chronic pain can be extremely difficult to pinpoint. So we might rely a little bit on, again, those videos from home where they're going to be more honest with their owners. And in that case, I might ask them to get a video of their dog going from a stand to a sit. And I can see there's a very slow hinge and then we're sitting. Whereas a totally comfortable dog, if you ask them to sit, they're like, boop, sitting, good, awesome, moving on with life. But again, the pet owner might not see that. And they're certainly not going to demonstrate that to me in the veterinary clinic, because I'm stranger danger and I might do mean things to them. Go ahead.
So basically what you're saying is all those videos that pet parents put on Instagram can be useful in diagnosing cognitive or pain issues in their pet.
Actually, yes. Very much so. Yep.
And here's their Instagram account. There's all the evidence you need right there.
Yeah, right. Just go ahead and send it on over. Kind of circling back around to the original question of, you know, how do we tell the difference between cognitive decline and a potential pain problem is, you know, again, video history. Because the history of a chronic pain problem, or excuse me, the medical and behavioral history is what I mean by that, of a chronic pain problem is going to be slightly different from cognitive decline. So for example, if it's a cognitive decline issue, I'll probably have some of that confusion first, or, you know, again, the kind of getting lost in your own house. Maybe I'll have those changes in social interactions, but for the most part, they're still running around. They want to go for walks. They're playing, they're doing their normal thing. It's just Every now and then you have just kind of this weird thing that comes up and you sort of like brush it off, like whatever, it's weird. Whereas with chronic pain, you will have that gradual, like, no, I don't want to run as much, or I don't want to run as long, or maybe I'm just not going to stand up to go investigate that thing as quickly as I would have before. So we don't have a lot of the confusion side of things, but there's a lot of decrease in activity, or even sometimes an increase in activity, because I do certainly have dogs with osteoarthritis who demonstrate what looks like sundowner syndrome, because they're able to sleep most of the day, but in the evening they start to get really antsy. And so that symptom by itself can be really hard to pinpoint down and say, is this pain versus is this senility? And so you have to kind of take it as a big picture in order to peel those pieces apart.
And now, do you also think this is where pet guardians really need to step up and advocate for their dogs? Because, you know, some vets will be like, oh yeah, this is just part of the normal aging process and whatnot. And you're like, no. Obviously I'm going to know my pet in a more deeper way than the vet ever will. So for pet parents who have vets who are kind of dismissing it just as old age, what would you recommend to them? Either, I mean, find a different vet or what, but how would you recommend to them that they really advocate for their pet to say, no, I know something is wrong?
It's a hard question, because there are definitely veterinarians out there who are still very sort of set in their ways, we'll call it. So for example, even within the last couple months, I've had a case where, you know, the dog, what was he doing? So he would be really gimpy and kind of funny at home. Oh, it was a little Westie. That was it. So a little West Highland Terrier. So he'd been kind of funny and a little snarky at home too, especially in the evenings. And, you know, I remember that his technician commented as he was walking into the building, and they're like, you know, I think he was slumping on one of his back legs. But then the doctor does their examination, and they're like, I don't see anything. He seems fine. You know, so even among different professionals in the veterinary community, there's a disconnect about how much our clinical examination should be feeding into our assessment for pain versus, you know, things outside of that and just like general behavior. But anyway, so if we're trying to advocate for our pet and our veterinarian doesn't think that there's a pain problem, you can always go back and say, look, here's some video that I took at home. See how he's limping on that left hind. Even if he's not limping here, I'm telling you, I'm seeing this at home. And you can also insist on having some diagnostics done. So in behavior worlds, you know, when you're in behavior specialty, a lot of the times we're diagnosing and treating based off of symptoms and not necessarily getting the really in-depth diagnostics. One, because a lot of our patients won't let you get those. They say, no, you can't touch me. Or, you know, Lance. Two, Lance, most of behavior is I'm trying to figure out what makes the most sense given what you're telling me. And so I've had plenty of cases in behavior specialty where we're like, well, look, she's 10. She has a history of like 20 orthopedic procedures, and she's suddenly getting aggressive with the owners, which has never happened before. That's probably a pain problem. So I really, really believe that the history from the family and the pet guardians is incredibly important, regardless of what medical condition we're concerned about. So having data from home about energy levels and sociability and activity and that video of how they're moving around, that can be really compelling evidence. If you can bring that to the veterinarian instead of just saying, well, I think he's uncomfortable, maybe. You know, because maybe isn't technically, it's not a diagnosis. And a lot of veterinarians aren't comfortable treating a maybe. But if we have some preliminary data and then we move forward with some maybe x-rays, or even going to a physical therapist could be a great idea too, not shift gears mid-thought. But, you know, physical therapists on the human side comment all the time about like, oh, I see that you're walking a little funny. What's going on? Like, oh, I've been to a million doctors and no one can figure out what's going on. And your physical therapist is like, well, your shoulders or whatever are out of alignment. Here you go. And then you're done. And the same is true in veterinary medicine, is, you know, physical therapists and those in rehabilitation are much better trained at looking for those subtle signs of pain, but they're also much better trained at treatment modalities for pain. So if ever in doubt, you're like, you know, I'd love a referral to a physical therapist just to cover all of our bases. And you don't have to be confrontational about it. Just be like, you know, I just want to get some more information. If nothing else, physical therapy is great for old age animals because it helps you keep you limber. So, you know, it two birds, one stone. I want to get a definitive eyeball on this and tell me, like, yes, this is definitely pain or no, it's not. And then I can get some fun physical activity exercises to help keep my older dog in shape too.
So would you also recommend pet parents keep a journal, a daily log of their dogs and their cats so that they can kind of start seeing some of these shifts over time?
Yeah, that can definitely be helpful. When we're looking at a several year time frame, though, I do worry that a daily log can be a lot to stay on top of, and it can be hard to see the data as it changes. So maybe even just every couple weeks, you know, ranking his activity and, you know, play drive and that sort of thing, scale of 1 to 5, like, how have we been doing? Because that's a little bit more of a digestible amount of information to be looking at over time.
Okay. Okay. So what are, so typically what are some of the first signs that will show up in a dog who has CCD?
So it really depends on the dog. I find the two most common symptoms are either going to be that change in activity level. So the sundowners, again, where we're more agitated in the evening or more active rather versus during the daytime, or you're going to have some of those confusion episodes. So those are probably the two big ones.
Okay. Does there tend to be like a typical age when you start seeing CCD more in dogs? Is there, you know,
excuse me. So there were some studies that we conducted a few years ago. I think the youngest dog someone has documented CCD in was 5. But by the time most dogs are about 12 years old, the majority of them are going to have signs of senility. And you have to keep in mind that when we're doing these studies, that these are basically surveys. And so if the owner doesn't necessarily know what they're looking at, their answer could technically be incorrect just because they don't know what the symptoms are, or they're not recognizing it in their pet. So I honestly think that by 12 or 13, you know, more than they were able to statistically report have some signs of senility. Same with people, though, you know, like, we all start losing our minds by the time we're, you know, in our 40s and whatnot.
Yeah. I've only lost a little bit of my mind. Now, does CCD affect certain breeds more than others? And is it something you're going to see more in males versus females, dogs who have been spayed and neutered versus dogs who have not been spayed or neutered?
I'm sitting here thinking about this question and I can't think of the answer. I don't think there's a gender correlation. Spay and neuter status, I don't think, has a direct correlation. I'm sure there are, you know, breeds that might be predisposed to neurologic problems in the first place. So, for example, Dobermans, German Shepherds, dogs that already have seizure disorders, you know, because their brain function is just not quite 100% normal anyway, they're going to be predisposed to having some other type of neurologic issue as well.
Okay. So you've taken the dog in and, you know, through observation and stuff, your vet says, okay, we think it's, you know, CCD. Now, what are treatment options and what can we do? I know it can't be cured, correct? Unless, you know, everything I was reading was wrong. I know there's cures, but what can pet parents do to help keep their dogs active, to kind of slow, I mean, I don't know if you can slow down the progress or how much you can. So what treatments are available and what should pet parents be doing to help slow down, I guess, so to speak, slow down the process a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, like we explored earlier, cognitive dysfunction is a degenerative disorder. So there isn't really a cure for it. But there are things that you can definitely do to either stave it off, so prevent it from starting in your older dog, or to slow the progression of it. So there are a lot of really nice over-the-counter products that they're essentially antioxidants. So, you know, when you're metabolizing things, you get these free radicals that sort of accelerate the aging process. So products like Senolife and, you know, some of the fatty acid supplements, those sorts of things are designed to help get rid of those aging chemicals so that things slow down. Plus, to be honest, a lot of those supplements are great for just like general health and, you know, good for bone, brain, skin, all that good stuff. So those are really helpful. And again, a lot of them are over the counter, so you don't necessarily have to get your doctor's permission to have those. They can be a little pricey, but, you know, in the nutraceutical world, usually the higher the price tag, the more research has gone into the product. So you get what you pay for, at least. Other things are, you know, again, similar with Alzheimer's, if we do brain games, keeping their brain exercising and thinking and active. And so in the dog world, our essentially doggy Sudoku is things like feeder toys, nose work, training, like teach your, I mean, old dogs can learn new tricks. So if you want to teach your dog how to like go fetch their toy and you always want to learn how to do it, now's a great time to really focus on that. Because not only is it sort of on your bucket list for this pup, but it's also going to help sort of slow down that, again, that degenerative process. So keeping them thinking, keeping them active, staying on a good, healthy, well-balanced diet with lots of omegas and fatty acids. That's a great jumping off point for most of these guys.
Okay. So are there any supplements that you would recommend, and should these dogs kind of be kept on a routine to sort of help them as well?
Sure. I mean, routine is great for any dog, no matter what. But yes, when you've got a senility problem, having a predictable, regular schedule can definitely help take some of the confusion and anxiety out of day-to-day life, because it comes a bit more predictable. They still might have those confusion episodes, but you can rein them back in a little bit more easily and be like, no, it's 10 o'clock, time for us to go do X, Y, and Z activity. And they're like, okay, yes, got it. I can go focus on this. And then as far as specific products are concerned, I mentioned Senolife already. Denimarin Advanced is another good one. So Denimarin was originally developed as a liver supplement for when you had some sort of, elevated liver values. But the Denimarin Advanced is a bit more targeted towards brain function. So SAMI is the active ingredient in that. That's also something that you can get in sort of your fatty acid supplements as well. Another one that doesn't get talked about a whole lot are probiotics. So there's been a lot of research on the human sector for the gut-brain axis, where your gut health, the type of bacteria that you have populating your intestines, can directly influence your mood and emotional stability, and therefore brain function in general. So probiotics, another one of those things that can be really beneficial for a lot of different disorders, but definitely for senility.
Okay, and some of these can be used as a, I guess, like a little bit of a preventative as well. Okay.
Definitely.
Okay. So once a dog is diagnosed with CCD, typically how long will they have to live? Or is that part of it dependent on how well they manage, you know, pet parents manage this? And I guess, what is the life expectancy of dogs with CCD?
Sure. I think it's really variable, you know, because there's very rarely a dog that just has a senility problem. They tend to have a lot of other health issues that they collect as they age. So as I'm sitting here, I can't think of a scenario where a pet just ended up needing to cross the rainbow bridge because of senility. It's usually a combination of They're confused, they're uncomfortable, they're not sleeping very well, they're anxious. And so at the end of the day, we decide like quality life is not great for this pet because of all these things, not just the senility. And so we make that decision for euthanasia. So I think it depends on a lot of factors. One, how quickly we recognize it as being a problem. Two, the age of onset. So the younger you are when you get a disease, you know, the more likely it is to end your life early, unfortunately. You know, and then how committed the family is to implementing some of these strategies to sort of slow the progression. But, you know, just like with a lot of other medical conditions, though, sometimes no matter what you do everything perfectly right. And at the end of a 6-month period, your pet is still significantly declining. And, you know, it's a bit of a gamble, I suppose, kind of trying to figure out where your individual pet is going to land in that time frame.
Okay. Now, because we know, you know, especially if your dog is up at night and everything, and with, you know, with the sundowner syndrome and things like that, what are some tips you can give to pet guardians who are living with a dog with CCD, and what kind of self-care things should they be doing as well? And what kind of role would you play in helping pet parents with dogs who have CCD?
Sure. So I think before we get to the meat of your question, we've talked a little bit about sort of the lower end of the spectrum where it's just been diagnosed. It's not horrible at this point, but eventually it'll get to a scenario where the sundowner syndrome is bad enough that the dog is literally up all night and no one is sleeping. And I've certainly had my share of those cases. You know, so in that scenario, we end up coming at it not just from the slowing the progression standpoint, but also the true symptomatic treatment. And so that's where we're getting into things like anti-anxiety products, because it does contribute to your anxiety. I mean, part of that DSHA acronym at the very end is anxiety. And so we might use sleeping aids to help these guys shift off of that sleeping during the day and being awake at night. So instead you get your thing, you know, we still do all of our enrichment during the day and we've got our really good schedule that we've talked about. But then in the evening after dinner, like, okay, I need to start simmering down. Here's some medicine to help calm your brain so that you can sleep at night. You know, and a lot of us that are intimately acquainted with pets that have behavior problems also have our own collection of them. So it's not unusual for many of these pet owners to be recognized like, oh, trazodone. I take trazodone to go to sleep at night, or my husband does, or my roommate's cousin or whatever. You know, so these products most of us are familiar with. And, you know, I don't want it to come across as we're trying to just knock your dog out. It's really, truly like their brains just can't turn off the way they're supposed to. And so we're using these products to help them function more normally so that they can rest and feel refreshed in the morning. And so that we, as their caregivers, can sleep and feel rested in the morning. You know, because a lot of the times when we're talking about caring for the caregiver, it's you have to take care of yourself or you cannot take care of anyone else. And so it is never the wrong answer to approach it from we all need to sleep. Here's something for you to sleep and then I can sleep by proxy. But even from a larger standpoint of are we having confusion during the daytime? You know, if you've ever had a family member go through Alzheimer's, that confusion can be really distressing. Like, I know I should know what I'm doing, but I don't. And it's frustrating and makes me anxious. And so some of these dogs, they do benefit from the addition of a daily anti-anxiety product like Prozac or Zoloft, for example, just to help them cope with those changes that are happening with them. Because it's not like I can sit my dog down and say, hey, buddy, this is why this is happening. You're going to have these episodes of confusion. They don't get it. So instead, I'm going to say, all right, here's a little thing to take the edge off so you're not so upset when these episodes happen. But that also sort of indirectly helps your sleep-wake cycles too. But anyway, going back to the original question, which once again, I have forgotten because I went on a tangent. What was your question, Lynn?
I guess, what tips can you give to pet guardians who are living with a dog with CCD?
Okay. So a little bit more on the schedule and the routine type of thing. Having a very specific going to bed ritual can help these guys, because it's not just the physical body that needs to turn off again, it's that brain that needs to as well. So having sort of our moments of busy, frenetic, intense interactions, whether that's play or we're doing a lot of training in the evening, whatever the case may be, try and get that out of the way by about 6 or 7 o'clock at night. And that way you've got this high and you have plenty of time to get everybody to simmer down before we go to bed at 10 or 11 o'clock at night. So we have our goofy fun time. We might have our dinner, and I'm a huge fan of feeder toys and puzzle toys, nose working activities for when it comes to feeding dogs like this, because the dog has a huge part of their brain dedicated to their sense of smell and their seeking and exploring. And, you know, we talked earlier about making sure that we're exercising that brain. Using their meals is a great way to do that. So if we have our dinners at about 7 o'clock at night, make it a game, make them go look for it, find, you know, go hide it under a pillow so they have to use their nose to get it. That's a great way to get them shifted from busy body to calm body, thinking mind. And so as they're, you know, we've gotten some of that physical activity out, we're using our feeder toys to get our mental activity out. And then typically after they finish with that meal, they are already sort of regulating and turning off. But there are also some other products and things that you can do. So if, you know, Lynn, you're probably familiar with this, but Through a Dog's Ear is a specific type of music that's been designed to help calm dogs down. And so you can play that as part of your going to bed ritual. It's those of us that are parents are going to see a lot of parallels between our kids and our dogs in this scenario. But this is what I had to do with my, he was 5 at the time, my son with ADHD, is we had to have a very structured way of going to bed. And we always listen to this same little sing-song story. You know, and that's kind of what the Through a Dog's Ear is supposed to be, is it's that auditory stimulation that calms you down. Massage is always good too, because a lot of our older dogs sort of like have kinks and tight muscles and stuff, and having that deep, long, like cuddles and like stroking their back and their body, that can be very relaxing and soothing. Because again, it's all about finding ways to take them from this heightened physical, mental state and bringing it down to a point where they can turn off and go to sleep for the night.
Hey, so at what point should we start considering euthanasia for these dogs? And at what point is it better to euthanize these dogs? Because I know reading different groups and stuff, this can be a very difficult decision for pet owners.
Definitely. You know, and especially in the scenario where they don't have a lot of obvious physical ailments. You know, while it's certainly common that we have senility and this whole like group of other things going on over here, there are absolutely going to be animals where the chunk of their problem is that senility. And then maybe we just have a little bit of arthritis sort of underneath all of that. So at the end of the day, it's always a very personal choice when the time comes to help your pet's passing. And, you know, one of the things that we did with my last dog when we first got her as a puppy was, what are 3 things that she absolutely loves to do? And then as she got older, we slowly started ticking those things off. So for her, it was morning snuggles, playing ball, and eating. So she passed when she was 12 and a half. So the first thing that we had to get rid of was her ball, because she had back problems. She couldn't play ball. She couldn't do the high intensity stuff anymore, but she still loved her morning cuddles and she loved her food. But then as she started to get older, she was diagnosed with lymphoma and she just didn't feel good. She didn't really want cuddles anymore. She would be with me all the time and she would still walk with me and hang out with me in different parts of the house. But one of our rituals in the morning had always been, I get my 20 minutes of like really big, intense snuggles, and then she's done with me for the day. No more touchy. So we lost our ball, we lost our cuddles. And then finally, when she started to really go downhill, she didn't want her treats and her food anymore. And so it was at that point, like, yeah, she was still getting around. She was going outside, but she wasn't enthusiastic anymore. And I knew it was time to let her go. And so I find that that tends to be a really helpful way for people to put perspective on it, because we're kind of going back to what's normal for your dog and how have those things changed at this age. And if you see those things that they used to enjoy go away one by one, what fun is life anymore? You know, again, it's not like I can say to my dog, like, I'm sorry, you don't feel good. Maybe tomorrow will be better. But dogs don't know what tomorrow is. They know that right now I don't feel good and I'm not happy and, you know, I'm miserable. So looking at it more from a how are they today perspective can be helpful too. You know, and then the last tactic that I've heard some people really enjoy is, you know, not even having that like journal per se, but having two jars. And each day you're going to put a marble in the jar of good day or bad day. And we're not having neutral days. It wasn't fine or okay. It was good or it was bad. And that's it. And then as the, you know, days or the couple weeks go on, you'll see one is going to fill up faster than the other. And that can sometimes, again, put a perspective on it, because it is really hard to see the forest for the trees when you're, excuse me, when you're in the trenches with these dogs, because maybe the last two or three days have been awful, just so awful. But you know what? The 2 weeks prior to this were actually really good. But it could also be the opposite, where the last 2 weeks have been awful and the last two or three days have been really good. And having that visual to help remind you of, like, this has been the last 2 weeks. Are we high in the bad day or are we high on the good day? And if we're really high on the bad day, then we have a tough decision to make.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Because I know that at that point, that's, you find a lot of pet parents who, you know, anticipatory grief and am I doing the right thing for the dog? That's always, you know, it's one of the most difficult decisions as a pet parent you have to make. You know, what is in the best interest of the dog as opposed to what is in the best interest of the pet parent? Because if we could, we would never let go of them, right?
Live forever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the other thing that I think about is because we don't have a one-to-one perception of how our animals are actually feeling, I usually try and make myself put a slightly worse spin on it, because dogs and cats, for that matter, they're always going to try and put a brave face on, right? So, you know, kind of going back to pain again, because I feel like pain and anxiety and senility, they're all very closely related, right? So if I can see an animal is uncomfortable and I can tell they're uncomfortable, they're probably at least 10 to 20% worse than what I think they are. And I try and keep that in mind when I'm assessing quality of life as well, because if I can tell they're struggling, it's probably worse in their mind than I think it is.
Okay, well, thank you. Is there any resources you would recommend for pet parents to learn more about CCD and how can they find support from other pet parents whose dogs have CCD?
Definitely. So, I mean, social media has definitely blasted off in the last 10 to 20 years. So there are a lot of Facebook groups out there. I'll be honest, I'm not on Instagram or Twitter, so I don't know the fancy things over there. But I know on Facebook, there's definitely several groups. You know, Senility Survivors, I think, is one of them. You know, old dog support groups, that kind of stuff. And even within your own community, a lot of us are going to have those older dogs. So making sure you're networking with people who live in your own neighborhood. But my favorite book, if you're an avid reader, is called Remember Me, and it's by Aileen Anderson, who's actually a veterinary behaviorist. And it goes into a lot about, you know, what does it look like and what are some things we can do to help, and sort of going through that process of living with a dog like this, as well as getting to that end of life thought process and conversation with the family.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time. And I appreciate you educating us more on canine cognitive dysfunction.
Yeah.
So thank you so much, Jesse. This has been wonderful.
Good. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Shortly after conducting this interview, Lynn made the very difficult decision to end Lance's suffering, both physical and mental. Lance needed intense treatment on a shoulder issue, but Lynn couldn't fathom her anxious boy, who hated the touch of strangers, enduring the therapy he would need. If you're struggling with behavior issues with your dog, please, please, please also go back and listen to my two-part discussion in February with Dr. Kyle Boland of the Ohio State University Veterinary Medical Center. In The Art of Balancing Behavior Issues, Dr. Kyle gave us incredible insight into understanding behavior issues and when and how to arrive at the decision of behavioral euthanasia. If you'd like to learn more about canine cognitive disorder, you can also go back to The Art of Aging Gracefully with Australia's leading expert in canine anxiety, Dr. Dennis Wormald. I'm Angela Schneider, owner of Big White Dog Photography in Spokane, Washington, and your host at One Last Network, signing off to go get some Bella snuggles. Listen to One Last Network on whichever podcast platform you prefer. We're on Spotify, Apple, and Amazon. Don't forget to hit follow or subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And if you have a friend who might be interested in our content, make sure you share us with them. Thanks for listening.